Turbo shotgun, not for the intro.
Yeah, I wouldn't know what to say. So, Hatem.
Hi, lovely listeners. Welcome to the RCGP Somewhere in Between podcast, the podcast for early career GPs that includes our first five GPs and GPs in training. Today, you're listening to me, Dr. Hatem Bloor-Hussain, who's providing you with the introduction to the podcast. So it's not the usual sultry tones of one of my co-hosts, Mira, but I'm joined here today by Kim, LJ, and Johannes. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hey.
So today's podcast is based around prison medicine, and we were joined by, well, I say we were joined, Johannes went and had a chat. Probably, I don't know if it was in Wormwood Scrubs, so it would be very cool if he actually did go to Wormwood Scrubs. To have a chat to Dr. Jonathan McAllister, who's a regional director at Practice Plus Group and a prison GP. So we're going to go into the interview. It's a real fascinating listen. Enjoy.
Hello, everyone. It's Johannes here. And today I'm joined by Jonathan McAllister. He's the regional medical lead for London and a jobbing GP in prisons. Hi, Jonathan. Thanks for joining me tonight.
Hi, Johannes. How are you?
Not too bad. Thank you so much for talking to us on the podcast. Just to begin, can you tell me a little bit about who you are and what your journey's been like to bring you to this point today?
Okay, well, I am 49 years old. I'm 50 in 2 weeks' time. I was born in Yorkshire in a small town called Home Firth, which for some older people may well know as where a BBC programme called Last of the Summer Wine was filmed. It's a beautiful little Yorkshire town. But I went to study medicine in Liverpool. I was a very happy 6 years there, and then stayed in the north for a couple of years and was training to be an obstetrician. But at some point I thought, actually, I wanted to get into GUM and HIV. So I moved to London because that's where it really was at the time. And I'm talking about sort of 1998. And I moved down and worked at St. Thomas's Hospital for a year in GUM and HIV. I thought it was fantastic. But at that point, I came a little bit disillusioned with working in obs and gynae and hospital work. And I decided to change to general practice, which was the most amazing, best decision I ever made. I made up my own GP rota. I did 6 months in psychiatry. I did 6 months in A&E sound at St. George's. And then I did my registrar. And at the time, a new scheme, which was a senior registrar in general practice in South London, a practice called the Hurley Clinic. And it was during that, a couple of years after that, I became a salary doctor, and I was introduced to a drugs and alcohol clinic. So they were quite new in expecting primary care to do quite a lot of the care of people with drugs and alcohol in the community. And I was involved with that and did my RCGP part one and two. I was encouraged to be involved quite a lot of those clinics. And as I got much more interested in that and the psychiatry for my GP jobs, I really moved towards working kind of forensics. And how I got into that was I contacted the Metropolitan Police in London, and they offered me a job. And so I was working part-time as a salary GP at the Hurley, and then part-time working for the Met Police as a forensic medical examiner, what we would be called in the olden days as a police surgeon. So I used to drive around in the evenings from various police stations, seeing people in custody who were under the influence of drugs or alcohol, mental problems, any kind of medical issue or injuries. Being called to see injured patients, injured police officers, people in hospital who'd been involved in accidents, and sometimes going to see sudden deaths in the community to pronounce life extinct. So that was a really exciting time for me. And I loved the job. And I did half and half work in the community and half doing that. But over a period of time, it became obvious to me that I really enjoyed working more in the forensic side with the custodial and secure settings, such as the police stations. And during that time, I became a partner at a practice in South London called Camberwell Green, which was a fantastic practice. I worked there for 10 years, but after a period of time, I realised that my really role was best used in with the police and in prisons, I just felt that that's where I could make the most difference, to be honest with you. Not that I wasn't making a difference in the community in a general practice. I absolutely loved it. It's an inner city, South London general practice, really, really, really tough work, but so rewarding. But actually, I enjoyed the even more challenging environment of working in prisons, working with an even more vulnerable population. And I felt that actually every day I worked in prison was actually, I felt I could even achieve more for my patients than I was in actually the community. And so I eventually decided to move into there in a much more permanent role. And so really I've been now working half and half in prisons and in the community now for probably about 6 or 7 years. And in fact, as time's gone on, I've spent more and more and more in time in prison. And actually at this moment in time, I'm full-time in prisons. And that involves 5 days a week full-time, of which one of those days is a kind of managerial strategic position as the regional medical lead. But the rest of the week is mainly just a jobbing GP doing general practice in prisons, to be honest. That's an upshot of my life so far. did I speed through it quite quickly? I think, didn't I? I'm sure I've missed some really important bits out.
That was great. I mean, it's always really good to hear when we talk to someone who's really kind of carved out a career that focuses on what they love. And I think it's really nice that, you know, this isn't a training path that just leads to one job and then you're stuck in that job, as it might be with a hospital career. It sounds like you've really kind of, you found your niche and made yourself a home there, which is really nice to hear. So thinking about prison medicine, you know, we're here really to hear about that, which is something that I think a lot of GP trainees maybe are aware exists somewhere in the world, but it has never really been something at the forefront of our minds. So can you tell me a little bit about just what it means to be a GP in prison? What is prison medicine all about?
So first and foremost, I'm a GP, and being a GP is, as you know, is a fantastic job. We come into contact with all kinds of interesting things day after day after day, and we can really make a difference in people's lives. But one thing about prison, as I said before, it's a very vulnerable population. These patients in the community have very chaotic lives. They often come into contact with GPs in the community. They are under the influence often of drugs and alcohol. They've had traumatic childhoods, traumatic lives. And when they come into prison, it's often the first contact they get with any kind of health professional or healthcare services. And so what we try to do, and what I try to do in prison, is I provide an understanding, empathetic and supportive general practice, primary care in the prison setting. And it's not easy. It's a challenge, of course, because we are what we say is guests for the prison service. So the prison service run the prison. We are guests that are invited into prison to provide healthcare to the prisoners, which are then our patients. And it, particularly in London, can I talk about London at the moment in particular? Or so London is got 6, 7, or 8 prisons, of which I've worked in most of them throughout the last 6 or 7 years. And they're all slightly different, but the prisoners are somewhat similar across there. There's a large amount of mental health. There's a large amount of drugs and alcohol, but it's surprisingly how much physical medicine there is. At the moment, I'm working at Wormwood Scrubs, which is a really, really famous prison. It's one of the most famous prisons in the UK. If you've ever seen The Italian Job with Michael Caine, the front of the prison is that. That is the front of that prison. And it's actually such an honour to walk through those gates every morning to go to work to provide care to those patients. And it really is important that we give them the care that they deserve, because one thing that they have not had is good healthcare. They just haven't had it in the community, and that's because healthcare is the last thing on their mind when they're in the community. I think I seem to have lost my way now.
That's right. I mean, it's all fascinating stuff. You've we talked a little bit earlier before the podcast about just how prisons work, and there's quite a lot of terminology that comes up that might come up again in the podcast. So can you tell me a little bit about what the different kinds of prisons are that exist in London and how they vary? You said that the patient population is quite similar across London, but is there anything different about the different categories of prisons, and how does that present itself to you?
So I'll talk about two or three prisons that I've particularly worked at. So when I first started moving into prisons, I was working in Belmarsh in South London, and Belmarsh is London's Cat A prison. And at the moment I'm working at Wormwood Scrubs, which is in West London, which is a Cat B prison, or what one call a Cat B remand. And in the past, and sometimes I still do that, I work at Brixton Prison, which is a Cat C. And prison nomenclature is divided into Cat A, Cat B, Cat C, Cat D. And essentially that categorization is about the seriousness of the offence, but really it's mainly about security. So what I mean by that is, clearly Cat A has the most serious offences, the most dangerous offenders, but also the most risk to the public, and that's really how it's categorised. So you still have, you know, serious offences in a Cat B, but Cat A means that it is more important that those people do not escape. I know it sounds really difficult for us to, as health professionals, to talk about escape, but actually to the prison service, that is, security is the most important thing. So it would be fair to say that I look after murderers in both a Cat A and a Cat B, or even a Cat C, but they go through a journey from the moment they are convicted and sentenced to work through that journey. And the ones that are more capable of escape and would be difficult if they get out into the community is really as the Cat A, and then it drops down to Cat B and then Cat C. And usually Cat C, something like Brixton Prison, is usually the people that by the time they get there, they're usually within about a year or a year and a half of going home. So things are a little bit more relaxed, and we are helping those patients plan for their next stages of life, where they're going to go out into the community. And then Cat D is what you'd call an open prison, and that means that even though they are prisoners still, they can sometimes stay over with their family at weekends, or they can go out to work during the day and come back to sleep in the prison at night. So it's much more relaxed. It goes from being fairly secure to slightly less secure, and it goes down like that. So it's all part of a journey, a progression through their, what they call their sentence. And so there are different needs throughout that point. What I did mention was Cat A and Cat B would really be what we call remands. And remand means you've committed a crime, or there's an allegation that you've committed a crime, then you will be arrested, and then you'll be taken to a police station, and then you'll be interviewed, and then you'll either be bailed, or if the crime is of a severity that you can't be bailed, you will then be remanded, which means you're kept at prison until your trial. And so where I work at Wormwood Scrubs at the moment, I see it's a remand prison. So IP see people that come from the court into the prison for the very first night to be held until they have their trial and then their sentence, and then after that they may well stay at that prison for a while or move to other prisons, what we call dispersal prisons at other parts of the country. And we talked previously, didn't we, about remand and how challenging a prison like that is. The reason that is challenging is because people have just come straight from the community. They are withdrawing from drugs or alcohol. They've got mental health problems that haven't been addressed, and that's maybe why they've ended up in prison, or they've been on the run. And that's why those people are fairly challenging, because they're hungry, they're tired, they're frightened, they're away from the family, and they just don't know what to expect, and volatile. And that can be difficult for us as health professionals to deal with those kind of situations, but it's important, and this is what I say to all new doctors that come into prison, is however challenging that is, what you have to do is put yourself in the the shoes of our patients. And what I mean by that is if they're aggressive to you, or they swear at you, or they're upset, or they're annoyed, you just have to try and imagine what they've been through over the last 24 or 48 hours. And even before that, what kind of lives they've had before they came into prison. You know, sometimes when you show kindness, people don't respond in the same way because they're not used to being treated in a kind and sympathetic and empathetic way. And often I have been challenged, verbally abused, never physically, but verbally abused in prisons, both in the receptions or in other parts of the prison. And what I try to do is step back to that and say, well, what has happened to you? What has happened to you in the past? What has happened to you today that is making you behave in the way that you are now? And actually, I'm extrapolating that back to what you probably understand as what we would call trauma-focused care. And it's very much en vogue in mental health at the moment. But I think that it can be extrapolated to all parts of medicine as to why people behave the way that they do. Why do people become addicted to drugs and alcohol? Because they are trying to mask their thoughts and feelings of traumatic events that have happened to them in the past. And I think that we need to take that forward throughout all our prisons, and we are doing that, to be more understanding of why our patients respond in the way that they do.
Yeah, and I think even when we're dealing with our colleagues and even with members of family as well, you know, taking that step back and trying to empathise and put yourself in their shoes when difficult situations arise. One thing I think is interesting is a lot of the patients that you're describing sound like when we come across them in a typical GP setting in the community, they might be the kind of patients that you'd kind of describe as a heart sink patient, you know, because they're difficult to manage and volatile and maybe unpredictable. How do you find the kind of, you must have an endless pool of empathy there that you can keep kind of managing this patient population who are so difficult. How do you approach that?
Well, I think it's true to say that we have a significant amount of mental health problems in prison, both from the low level depression and anxiety right through to psychosis and also psychopathy and personality disorder. But I think that I'm not so sure whether I get the same kind of heart sink patients that I do in the community. I think maybe that's why I enjoy being in prison. I don't think I get the real volume of heart sinks, but it's true we have some challenging patients. And you learn to deal with it over a period of time. And we've got actually a lot more people around us than we might have in the community. So in prison, we've got a huge wraparound mental health team with psychologists, with psychiatrists, with mental health nurses, with therapists, we've got so many people there that are working with us that we can share the load and the difficulty of the most challenging cases, both mental health cases and physical health cases, to be honest. But I go home in the evening less tired and less mentally stressed and withdrawn than what I used to do in the community. And I think one of the things we talked about before was about the sheer volume and the workload. Because I think that when I was a partner in a GP practice, I was seeing probably between 18 and 20 people in the morning and 18 and 20 people in the afternoon, plus all my tasks, plus my prescriptions, plus my doc man, plus blood results, plus phone calls, plus emails. And it was nonstop. And I'm not saying that it isn't busy in prison, but it's a different kind of energy and it's a different kind of speed in which we work. We are allowed to have more time with our patients and they need that because often by the time they come to us, they do have three or four items that they want to talk about. And sometimes it can be difficult to get hold of a health professional, even in prison sometimes. So I feel that we need to give that time to them. It would be quite routine for us to spend 15 or 20 minutes with a patient in prison. So it might well be in a morning surgery in prison, I might see between six or eight patients max. and then again in the afternoon. But one of the things that we, so for instance, like if I arrived there in the morning, maybe about, I usually get there about 7:30 or 8, and there, you may think that's actually quite early. And I suppose it is early because you don't normally start. You do start at 7:30 to 8 in a community general practice, don't you? But at 7:30, I would arrive and I'd join the handover with all my nurse colleagues. So that's why, in a way, it's general practice, but yet we're really close with our nurses and our other health professional colleagues. So we meet together at 7:30 for our handover. We talk about the issues that have happened overnight, the issues for today, supporting each other before we start looking at the blood results and the tasks and the prescriptions that need to be done before we actually start doing our clinics. And I spoke to you before about the challenges of doing our clinics in prison, because what I said before is that we are a subspeciality of general practice working in prison as guests, and therefore we have to work within what we call the prison regime. And it's something that GPs find quite challenging when they first come into prison, because we come into prison and say, I can't believe this is being done this way. I'd love to change it and make it better. And we that's why we do want new doctors coming in, to bring new ideas and fresh ideas about how to do things. But at the same time, we have to follow a specific regime. And what I mean by that is prisoners' security is key. And therefore, prisoners are unlocked at 9 o'clock every morning for their breakfast. And then they're locked back up at 12 o'clock. And then they're unlocked at 2 o'clock. And then the clock back up at 5 o'clock. And they're counted three or four times a day to make sure that the right number of prisoners is still in the prison. And so we can only gain access to our patients during those very, very specific times. Now, I'm not saying we can't go to them if there's an emergency. If there's an emergency, clearly we can. But so for instance, if I wanted to chat with someone about starting a cholesterol tablet, then I can't go and do that at 12 o'clock lunchtime, because they've all been locked up for the lunchtime and you may say, why are they locked up at lunchtime for an hour? Because the prison officers go off for their lunch, and from a safety point of view, all the prisons have to be locked away during that hour or two while everybody goes off for the lunch. So you gain access to the prisoners really at the permission of the prison. That's quite challenging for people to accept, actually, that we can only do our role within certain very specific parameters. And sometimes it helps when you have good relationships with prison officers, because then they are willing to say, oh, okay, doc, yeah, of course I'll open the door for you to see Mr. Brown or whatever. And then you can get your work done much easier. So It like in any way, you need to have good relationships with your colleagues, not just both your health professional colleagues, but your prison colleagues as well at the same time. So
it's quite interesting, the idea that almost you're seeking out the patient, whereas in the community, we'd probably quite like to lock up our patients for a few hours so they couldn't keep calling us and knocking on the door.
Sorry to interrupt you there again, Johannes, because you just brought up a really, really important point to us. And so, say, for example, you're sat in your surgery in the community and your patient doesn't turn up, you get a DNA. Now, when you're seeing 20 patients in the morning, it would be fair to say that sometimes you get the odd DNA and you think, oh, thank goodness I've had a DNA, because at least I'm going to be able to see every patient, and otherwise I'm going to be snowed under. But actually, if we get a DNA in our clinic, then it's not because the patient has decided not to turn up. There are so many other factors. And what we do is, before COVID times, our prisoners would be brought to the healthcare department, and then they'd be stored in kind of like a room. And then when it's their turn, they'd be brought to my GP. But because of the way COVID and cohorting and bubbles and safety and everything in prisons, we tend to now go to the wings, or we would go to the cell to see them. And it's not ideal. Clearly, it's not ideal to consult someone in a cell. But actually, if it's a matter of not seeing them at all, then it's really important to see them. And so even before that time, if somebody wasn't brought to my clinic, I couldn't leave that. I couldn't write that as a DNA. That would be so wrong. And what then we have to do is we have to seek them out. We have to go to their cell and ask them why they didn't come. And if they say, okay, you know, I don't need to see you now, it's got better, then that's absolutely fine. But actually, if I was to make a guess at the number of people I went to and spoke to, I would find at least over half of those were found out that the prison officers didn't unlock them, or that they didn't even know they had an appointment. Or, and this is even more frustrating for patients and us at some points, is that they may only get a certain period out of the cell at a time, a certain hour or so. And in that hour, they're expected to contact the family on the phone. They're expected to have a shower. They're expected to have exercise. They're expected to have some education. And, you know, and sometimes when you've got patients there or prisoners who have only got an hour to do all that, health isn't their priority. You know, what is it? What do you want to choose today? Seeing the doctor or talking to your girlfriend or your wife or your baby daughter on the phone? It isn't a choice that they should have to make, really. And so that's why it's always important to seek those people out to ensure that they get to see their doctor.
I suppose one of the benefits is that if you ever have to do a home visit, you know, it's only going to be a few hundred metres down the corridor.
Well, sometimes I write in the notes home visit. Essentially, our home visits are to the cell.
Yeah.
But you're right. Sometimes if you had a long walk in the community to a home visit, I'm really lucky that I only have to walk 100 yards or 200 yards.
Yeah. One of the things that really interests me is just how you manage risk in a prison setting and about the decision making you have to kind of wrap your head around when you have a patient in front of you who we might normally quite casually, you know, ask them to pop to A&E or even send an ambulance to them. How do you manage those kind of more acute situations when you're in such a different setting?
Well, I'll come on to that. I just wanted to say quickly about the so about risk and stuff. So what we have is like an emergency team in the prison that is really nurse led, but in fact we have the ability to be able to join that. So for instance, we're all ILS trained, which is intermediate life support in prisons, not basic life support, but intermediate life support. We have paramedics that work with us. We've got really experienced nurses on our emergency bleep. But also I carry a radio, which means I hear any emergencies across the prison and I can run and help them out. That adds excitement for me. It makes me keep up with all my skills. So it means I'm not just doing basic general practice. I'm doing a bit of everything, and that keeps me interested and excited. And what we break our two emergencies into are blue calls and red calls, blue code and red code. And you may say, what's the difference with that? Well, a red code is fairly obvious. It means blood. So if anybody's hemorrhaging, major hemorrhage, then of course that would be called as a code red. Anything else that's kind of life-threatening would be a code blue. And those, when they're called code blues and code reds, they automatically patch through to London Ambulance Service. So the ambulance service, and that's automatically sent as a category one. And I think it just means that prisons, because of the risk that's associated with prisons, when we have one of those codes, we automatically get a very quick response. And that's usually with a paramedic, a senior paramedic, and an ambulance. But by the time we've got to those emergency codes, if we believe that an ambulance is not wanted, we stand that down straight away. But sometimes, of course, we do want colleagues to come in and just give their expert opinion, because sometimes I might be the only GP in the prison, and sometimes I need a second opinion from someone who's much more experienced working in a kind of acute emergency situation. So sometimes they'll come in and we'll have a discussion and then they'll go away and they'll not go to hospital. So we really appreciate our ambulance colleagues coming in. With regards to risk and stuff, I mean, yeah, it's really important how you pick that up, because we are only commissioned to provide a primary care service. I'm not actually providing an emergency service here. So So if you were providing primary care, like you said, and you felt a patient was ill, they needed to go to hospital, we can either say, listen, why don't you take yourself off to A&E and get a second opinion, or we'll send you up there for an X-ray, or we'll send you this for a scan or some blood tests. It's quite different here because our prisoners don't have the option to take a second opinion. If they disagree with what you've done, they don't have the option to say, actually, I'm going to go somewhere else. And they really rely on us to have good clinical skills and make good clinical judgments. And sometimes we do make mistakes. Sometimes we don't get it right. And that's why it's always good to have other GP colleagues in the prison or other senior nurses to just give their opinion. But, you know, I've on a number of occasions. So, for instance, an example would be someone's had a fight. They've injured the hand. You're not sure whether it's broken. This patient's a really challenging patient with very difficult mental health issues, very violent, very aggressive. What do we do? The prisoner's saying, we don't really want to take him out. We've not got enough staff to take him to hospital. What are you going to do? And you really have to have some really good clinical skills at making a decision about who needs to go where or what. Because, you know, if you don't send... You know, if you don't send someone with a broken hand to hospital and it's not dealt with within 3 or 4 days, then of course there are certain long-term consequences that can come from that. So but there are other things. I mean, I mentioned a case before when I used to work at Belmarsh that had a gentleman who'd got an injured elbow. He'd been in a restraint with the police prison officers. And we are looked at the prison to make very, very difficult decisions about who needs to go to hospital and when, because we can't send everybody. We've got staff to send some people out for the most urgent things, but we can't send everybody to hospital every day. We've got to try and manage as much as we can in the prison. So for an instance, the one that was restrained at Belmarsh, he was a Category A prisoner. He was in the special housing unit. So a very, very challenging, dangerous prisoner. Possibility of escape, those kind of problems. And one thing about Category A prisoners is that when they leave, they need to have what we call a Category A escort. And that's an armed escort, usually of 3 or 4 police cars, occasionally a helicopter. And so as a GP making a decision about an injury as to whether somebody needs to go to hospital or not, to be able to escalate an armed guard and a helicopter is actually quite a big decision. And on that day that this happened, it was a Boxing Day, and I had to ring the A&E in South London and speak to the registrar on call and tell him that I was sending this man and he was coming with an armed police escort and could they make some space for him? And, you know, you feel quite important. It feels actually quite surreal when you do something like that. But actually, when he went there and he had his X-ray and his injury was fine. It was just a soft tissue injury. So I felt a bit silly, to be honest. But actually, you know, the prison would turn around and say, well, doctor, you didn't really need to go in the end, did he? But actually he did, because it was still a significant soft tissue injury. But the consequences of it being a broken elbow and not being treated, you just don't want to think about it. So you are the patient's advocate. You know, the prison want to provide good healthcare. They expect us to provide excellent healthcare, but we need to provide it in a safe environment, i.e. we are their advocate. And if we think they need to go to hospital, they will go to hospital. And that's important that we have the confidence to say to our prison colleagues, this is my decision and this is what I want. I've had a couple of occasions, one where that's been overridden for security reasons. And there's nothing I can do about that. I mean, one was just an injured finger, and I was told that actually a patient couldn't go out on that day. He might have to go 3 days later, and that's difficult. But I can only give my advice. That's my advice, and I can't force the prison to take people to hospital if they don't want. If they can't manage it for security reasons, and sometimes they can't. There are sometimes where that may happen. I did talk to you about risk, and often we get quite a lot of assaults in prison. As I said before, I've been verbally abused a number of times, but no more in prison. In fact, actually more in the community than in prison. But I've never actually been physically assaulted in my 22 years of being a GP. and definitely not in prison, but there are prison assaults and there are prison office assaults. And I do know of prisoners being quite severely assaulted in prison. I mean, I've had one occasion where somebody's been slashed across the face, that's cut through the parotid gland, that's cut through the facial nerve. And those are times where you need to really remain calm and just bring an air of understanding to the whole situation. And you might not see that in general practice. So that's why this is, even though it's kind of a niche area of general practice, it's got so many interesting parts to it that we've mentioned before. So like I talked to you about, I do general practice clinics, I do mood clinics, I look after the inpatient unit, I look after people that come in on their first night, I review people in multidisciplinary meetings. So there's huge different facets to the job that across the whole week that add lots of different interests to it.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like there's a lot of kind of interesting medical risk to be managed, but actually in terms of the risk for you and your colleagues, it sounds like you feel quite safe, which is reassuring. The thing I find really interesting listening to you talk about making those decisions is that when I was applying to do GP training, I was looking at possibly doing something like the rural track in Scotland, because I love the idea of, you know, being in an isolated community, you know, potentially an island community where you do have to make these big decisions and you have to decide, you know, are we going to fly this person back to the mainland? You know, is it safe to do that in these conditions? And it never clicked to me that you can be that kind of decision maker, you know, essentially in central London, you know, without having to go and spend a year of your life on a weather-beaten rock, a beautiful weather-beaten rock. But nevertheless, I know it's a big sacrifice.
I totally agreed with you because we don't have all, you know, we've got ECG machines, we've got the ability to take bloods, we've got stethoscopes, we've got things like that, but we don't have chest X-rays and we don't have all huge massive swaths of equipment. So what you're relying on a bit more is about your clinical skills and your acumen. But that doesn't mean that we can't, that doesn't mean that we don't appreciate, what I mean by that is it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be a GP of years and years and years of experience to be able to come and work in prisons, because different types of GP bring different kinds of skills. But you're right, we are making very difficult decisions about our patients. And those are the ones that we sometimes get a little bit anxious about and we think about in the evening. But actually a lot of the time, I think one thing that's really important that I wanted to get across anyway is that every contact that we have with our patients is really important. I'm not saying that contact that you don't have in the community isn't important, but relationships are really important between our patients and us in prisons, because they've always been let, a lot of the time they've been let down by people in the community, both health professionals and other people. So if you can forge a relationship with them, but you need to make sure you follow it with that. So for instance, what I found really important over the years is if you're going to see a patient and you're going to tell them you're going to come back tomorrow, you must absolutely go back tomorrow. You must absolutely go back tomorrow, because if you don't, your relationship is over. Because prisoners really, really appreciate that. Like, you're almost like it, your bond is your word in a way, that you, if you say you're going to go back, you must go back. And every time you see the person, you must do the absolute best for them. Everybody does, every doctor does that. Of course, every time they come into contact with their patients. But you don't want to go home at the end of the day thinking you've not done everything that you need to do, because it still can be a volatile place and things can happen that you don't expect. So that's why you need to dot all the I's and cross all the T's every single time. I mean, that helps. It helps a bit if you're a bit of a perfectionist, of course. But doctors and GPs aren't they? They are perfectionists. That's how they do their job.
Yeah, absolutely. We've definitely got some perfectionists on my VTS team. So maybe I'll get them to apply. So, I mean, one of the reasons you were kind of as keen to talk to us as we were to hear from you is that I know that you know, there's a need for more kind of young blood coming into prison GP. What kind of things, apart from, you've already mentioned perfectionism and some of the traits that would be helpful, what other things would you say you're looking for in a GP who wants to kind of work in prisons? What kind of skills do you think they need to bring?
Wow, I mean, I'm not sure whether you actually need any particularly extra skills to work in prison. I think that what the important thing is to encourage people to come in and experience it. I think people need to come in and see how we are practicing general practice in some of these really challenging Victorian prisons where our patients are kept in tiny little cells, sometimes in twos, on bunk beds with a toilet in the same room, and expecting them to maintain good health. And so you need people with confidence, who are empathetic, who understand a little bit more about the challenges of what we're seeing, because it's all the skills I would expect from that I would expect in any general practitioner. That's why you need to be a general practitioner in prison, because you need those skills, the clinical skills, but you need those listening skills, you need those observational skills, you need that empathy, the listening. Sometimes no one's listened to our patients ever. They can be aggressive, they can be loud, they can shout, they can scream, and it's not our job to scream back at them. It's our job to listen and just to sit there and just listen, and those that it's listeners that we need. That's what we need: people who are willing to listen and make sensible decisions about people. One thing I always say to prisoners: I'm here to help you find out what you need to improve your health, not necessarily what you want. We are just steerers and guiders, I suppose, from that point of view, aren't we? But I mean, clearly in London, I've got male prisons. We've got some female prisons outside. We've got both male and female doctors working in prisons across all prisons in London. And I don't think there's any difference between what they can offer. I think that we've seen a dynamic change across prisons with regards to prison officers over the last number of years. So you'd imagine prison officers used to be 6'4", ex-army, white, young men. But I think over the last 10 or 15 years, you've seen a radical change of a lot more women prison officers, a lot more black and ethnic minority. My gut feeling of working over the last 7 or 8 years in prisons is that dynamic in the prison officers has really made a difference to the dynamics in prison. I think they seem to be calmer, and there seems to be less violence than there was before, and maybe even less self-harm than there was before, because difficult young men in prison with difficult lives are not going to respond well to big 6'4" white men. They're going to respond to all kinds of different people. And I think that's why we're seeing a dynamic change. So I think that as time goes on, we'll see the same dynamic change in what we're seeing amongst GPs and on all health professionals in prison. And I think that's for the better. That's coming from a man who's white and 50.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, I think it's really important, even in the community. I think, you know, there's still an underrepresentation, or there's a lack of representation in the doctor community, you know, because just historically we have fewer, we actually have more female doctors coming through now, which is great. But, you know, many fewer, I think, minority doctors who are kind of on the front line. And I think the more that we represent our patient population, more we'll be able to build that rapport with them. But it's really good to hear. One thing we talked about a little bit before the podcast was about kind of support and training, and what's being developed to try and kind of formalize and kind of really reinforce this as a subspecialty. Can you talk a little bit about what's happening in that space?
So we've had some success in London, where we've managed to make contact with some GPs who are running some of the VTS schemes in South London, such as King's and Guy's St Thomas's, where we've brought VTS people into some of the prisons to have a look round, and some people have then chosen to work in prisons in short periods of time. So we had a GP principal who worked in South London who came and did a sabbatical for a year in Brixton. But we want to encourage more people to come and look round and see what it's like. But I think it's fair to say that people who are not working in prison see it as a bit of a Cinderella subject. It's a bit dirty. Why would you want to work in a prison with those kind of people? And I think I've tried to say in this podcast tonight how these vulnerable people deserve to have the same healthcare as everybody else. But in the past, because it's not really been a particularly subject that people have been interested in, or a section of general practice, that it's not really been particularly dynamic. So we do have the Royal College of General Practitioners Secure Environments Group, which is a large group of people that get together. And in fact, we had a conference in earlier on, just before Christmas in Newcastle, which was a fantastic conference where we were networking from all across the country with people working in prisons, both doctors and nurses. That's fantastic. I'm at the moment negotiating with some of the CGGs in South London about what we would call a foundation. And what that is where the CCGs and education, Health Education England are sponsoring at least one session a week and possibly two sessions a week as part of a portfolio of newly qualified GPs particularly. So you would work, you know, six sessions maybe, or four or six sessions in the community in the general practice, and maybe one or two in prison. And which we're at the moment trying to get that off of the ground. That's starting to take shape. We do have GPs on various VTS schemes working in some of the prisons in London. We've got one starting at Pentonville Prison in the next couple of weeks. I know that there's one GP trainee working in a prison at Wandsworth Prison at the moment. And I know it's happening all over the country. So there is some way of bringing new people into the prisons. And also we've also been in some of my colleagues higher up in the company I work for have been in discussion with the Faculty of Forensic Legal Medicine, which is a subspecialty of the Royal College of Physicians, or the Royal College of Medicine, I think. And so what we're trying to do is make it more, I'm not going to say I'm going to use the word academize. I don't even really think it's a real word, but I'm going to use it because it sounds good. To try and make it that we can, so for instance, I'll give an analogy. So a number of years ago, you could just be a GP. You could just do a course and you become a GP, but now it's much more structured and you have to really do the MRC GP, don't you, to become a GP? Whereas that's what we're trying to achieve. I mean, obviously you have to be MRC GP to come and work in prisons, of course, but we're trying to say, well, actually there's going to be an even higher exam for this, a different kind of exam, which is going to be a member of the Faculty of Forensic and Legal Medicine. So that's all in progress at the moment. Happening over the next couple of years. It's quite an exciting time, and I hope it's going to encourage people to want to come in and work with us and bring their skills and make more of a speciality of it rather than just such a Cinderella speciality.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I mean, you've definitely tempted me to think about it. So I think we've got a really good insight into your role and what's happening over the coming years in terms of this as a career. If people who are listening today are interested in kind of moving in this direction or maybe doing a taste a day or a taste a week, what would you suggest they can do to kind of get involved?
Well, I mean, I think that the important thing is that they need to contact me. Of course, I'd love them to contact me. And I can then, I've got contacts with my prisons. So my prisons, which are Practice Plus prisons in London, which is Pentonville, Wormwood Scrubs, Brixton. But I've also got another couple of prisons that are available that I can put people in contact with if they want to be closer to home. So, and I've also got contacts in quite a lot of prisons around the whole of the UK. So if people want to contact me, then I can obviously direct them to the right place. I just think it's important that people just come and try it just for a look round. I've showed lots of people around over the last year or so, and people come in and they say to me, wow, I've had such a fantastic day. I didn't realize you were trying to do general practice here in this environment. It's really challenging, but wow, you know, it's such a great job. And so just when people get their foot in the door and have a look around for an hour or two, they just think, wow, this is something I would like to do. And that's what I just feel that we need to get people through the big front door.
Brilliant. Yeah, I cycle past Wandsworth Prison every day, so maybe I'll just give them a knock next time I'm cycling home from work. Wandsworth.
Ah, you see, I can get you in there if you want to go there.
I never thought I'd want to get into Wandsworth Prison, but maybe. Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for your time. It's been really fascinating to talk to you, and I'm sure everyone who's listening will have found that really useful.
Thank you so much, Johannes, for inviting me to talk today. It's really been great just to tell people how wonderful this subspeciality is and come into prison and really make a difference.
Yeah, and it's brilliant to talk to people who are passionate about what they're doing. So thank you so much for your time.
Well, I really enjoyed that. I have a completely different world that I wasn't really expecting an insight to. But initially, let's go to you, Johannes. I mean, you were there with him when you were having the conversation. What were the best bits that you took from that interview?
I think one of the main things was just how enthusiastic that man is about prison medicine, and it's infectious. I think, you know, we were briefly talking before. I mentioned the podcast, like, by the end of the conversation, I was thinking, you know, which prison should I go and start working on, or knocking on doors to try and find an opportunity. And I think, Kim, you mentioned as well that, you know, you were quite surprised by being tempted in the direction of prison medicine after listening to that. But yeah, it was just really great to have a chat to him. And it's really refreshing to hear the voices of people who are really happy and excited about their work. What did you think, Kim? What was it that persuaded you to get behind bars?
Literally. So I've never come across prison medicine before. I don't think I've been to any kind of workshops or lectures on it and had anybody talk about it before. So it's been a bit of the unknown. I used to work in a hospital where it had quite a kind of, it was in an area which had quite a high population of prisons. So I've worked with prisoners in secondary care, but not in primary care. And I thought he was just really inspiring, wasn't he, about how passionate he was about his job. Really kind of, you know, made the point about how these people have had difficult lives and how you really need to take that into consideration when you're treating them, which I thought was a really interesting and great way of looking at it. And by the end of the podcast, even for someone who'd never really had expressed any interest in prison medicine at all, even I thought I might drop by Wandsworth Prison and have a chat. So yeah, he made it sound really interesting, and just a great way to kind of maybe break up the monotony of GP sometimes, I think, by doing something a bit different.
Yeah, I think that was something that I really took from it as well, in terms of just really diversifying your career with something that actually is not typical of what I guess most GPs do, but it's not something that you tend to get traditional experience of in your training. And actually, I think that's a shame, really. I think we probably should find ways to get trainees in there. And obviously, that was quite one of the clear points in speaking to him, to have a role in prison medicine as trainees, maybe, or even at least going there for a taste of days or even weeks, just to get a bit of experience, because it is a really different patient demographic. It's quite a vulnerable patient cohort, and therefore that in itself comes with lots of skills in terms of sort of management and communication. You know, I really like that point with how he sort of mentioned, if you tell a patient that you're going to go and see them again the next day, you must deliver on that. You must go and see them the next day. Otherwise, you almost lose that rapport and that trust that you have with that patient. Now, I don't think that's too different to the type of relationship you have with your patients in the community and in your traditional general practice setting. But these individuals are so reliant on people that they can trust and are looking for people that they can trust. And as a GP, you know, you have a real privileged opportunity to be able to do that. And then there's also the discussion around providing, you know, a good quality community care to these people. And it's fascinating, isn't it? Because the point that he made in terms of them not, the patients not having good quality community care, probably being a big factor in actually one of the reasons why they're there in the first place. And then when they're actually in prison, they suddenly are getting good quality care, you hope. And that's really a big change for the person. And hopefully in the future, will then instill confidence in healthcare services when they're, you know, eventually rehabilitated into normal society, I guess. What were your thoughts about it, LJ?
So I've read a book once. It was, I think, Memoirs of a Prison GP. And I think she worked in a women's prison. So it was similar, but not quite the same. And I remember thinking, wow, that sounds really interesting. And that must have been a few years ago. And I've not really thought about it since. So I was really excited to listen to this one. And I was exactly the same by the end of it. I was thinking, oh, God, like I should write his email down and email him and try and do a taste a day if they'll take me from Thames Valley. I think, yeah, you're right, Hatim. I think one of the most important bits that I took from it was that sort of their punishment is that they've been deprived of their liberty, not deprived of their healthcare sort of thing. So why shouldn't they receive good healthcare? And I just think that's just really important. And it's one of those things that, you know, when maybe, I don't know if you guys had this, but when I became a doctor, someone said, oh, what would happen if you were in A&E and you were asked to treat like a murderer? Like, would you treat them any differently? And I was always a bit like, well, I'd hope not, sort of unethical. So it was really good to hear it like presented the way he did about, you know, that's why we treat everybody the same. It's because they deserve it and it's like a right and all that sort of thing. So yeah, it was really interesting to listen to. That's what I took from it anyway.
I think one of the good things about A&E is that it's not in the history you normally take. You don't normally ask, you know, are you a murderer, or, you know, how many kittens have you eaten this week? So sometimes you kind of don't have to make that judgment. Because I think if you do know what's happened, it can be quite difficult to separate yourself. And I think if my memory is correct from the conversation I had with him, he was saying that you don't necessarily always know exactly what, you know, what the background is, and there isn't necessarily an interest in knowing, because it can disrupt that relationship. But going back to what you were saying, Hatim, about how it could be a real turning point in terms of, you know, suddenly receiving quality care, that reminds me of the work of Red Thread, who are a charity that work on Mind Kim's Patch, and they use those kind of critical moments, you know, when someone comes into A&E with a gang-related injury or something, and they kind of take the heat of that moment as a way to turn something around for people. And I imagine that, you know, if someone's first day of a first prison term has some kind of degree of acceptance and warmth and care, then that might be a really important moment in kind of turning around their view on the world and their view on their future. So I think it is a really impactful career choice. And I also think the nice thing about this, talking about it from a portfolio career perspective, is that actually it is still quite GP. It's possibly even more GP than regular GP, because it really does kind of get to the crux of, you know, helping a defined vulnerable community who have really significant need. And you can just do the really important work and you know, maybe less of the peripheral, less of the admin and the other things that we deal with on a day-to-day basis.
There are two other areas of interest from the conversation that I wanted to unpick a little bit. And one of these was, you mentioned there, Johannes, about the career. It's a really interesting portfolio career, but it's one that has a very undefined pathway. And so firstly, it's fantastic to hear someone who's willing to engage and willing to say, please come and contact me. And I can hopefully give you an opportunity to get some experience, you know, through the areas that I work in or through the people that I know across the country. And that's really refreshing to see in a particularly an area or a subspecialty that is, you know, not as clear to to us through our traditional training pathways. So that was really nice to establish. But it was also nice to think about what they were doing to make this more of a normal career path in the future. And that for me is especially interesting because, you know, often unless we sort of professionalize some of these careers, and unless we actually make clear what the opportunities are, what the skills, what the competencies you need to work in these spaces, then you lose a whole cohort of talent. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see if what that means in the future for our own training and our own pathways. And LJ, you're interested in MedEd, for example. So yeah, how do you feel about that?
So MedEd is being professionalised as we speak with standards from the academy and things like that. So that's I'm sort of seeing it from the MedEd side as well, where there's like kind of you've got your clinical teaching fellows, and then you've got your sort of MedEd roles being built in. And I think I actually really liked the end of that interview where he was sort of talking about how they're building that professionalised, standardised way of sort of getting into prison medicine. So that was really interesting.
And I mean, is anyone here planning to now go and do at least a taste a day or a shift in one of the prisons, or even start to sort of think about what skills they can demonstrate? Because I mean, to be honest, if you look at our portfolios, there's plenty we can show in our portfolios around the skills that you might be able to demonstrate by going and doing a shift or going and shadowing.
So it wasn't just prison medicine I was thinking about as well earlier. It was more like it kind of inspired me not just to think about this sort of very specific group, but also in the past I've worked in a GP practice that dealt with drugs and alcohol dependence, and they were like sort of specialists in the wider area that they were sort of, they saw those patients, specifically homelessness as well. So homeless patients and different practices that deal with them. So I think actually it's inspired me not just to look down the prison medicine route, maybe get taste of days in that, but perhaps seek opportunities in those different quite defined populations as well.
That's a great point. I know at some point in the future we want to do an episode on homeless health, for example. Kim, I know you've done some work in that space.
I haven't actually, but I'm very interested in it, and definitely in touching base with some people now to come and talk to us about homeless medicine, because it is a specialist area, isn't it? Just like prison medicine is a specialist area, and I think, you know, a lot of people GPs are quite interested, or GP trainees are quite interested in drug and alcohol, and then specialist interest in mental health, and all of that is in prison medicine. I guess it covers, it's weirdly specialised but quite broad, which I think is probably what's appealing about it. And I loved it when he was talking about the emergencies that they get in prisons, and kind of the challenges of that, and how they have to, you know, how actually the logistics of sending someone to a hospital and making that decision is really quite challenging. So it just brings another kind of layer to your day, doesn't it? But you know, but he very much spoke about how the pace was a lot less than kind of in normal GP, and so he had time to think, time with patients, and it was just really nice to hear about someone who really, really, really enjoys their job, had kind of perhaps a little bit of a, you know, a crisis earlier on in their career where they thought, do you know what, I'm not enjoying myself here, but yet found their avenue in their future career within GP, which I think is really nice, because I think there is, GP has so many opportunities and so many different pathways, and unless you hear about them and you hear inspiring people talk about them, you kind of think sometimes that, oh, this is it and I don't like it and what am I going to do? But yeah, it just kind of really reinforced the opportunities that are available.
And oddly accessible, the way he was saying how the skills that we're building towards just being a, in quotation marks, just a GP, like in the end, like daily jobbing GP, we're building all the same skills and the same sort of, we've got all the same traits to go into that anyway. So we're moldable, and that's like nicely reassuring, I think.
The other thing that I wanted to pick a little bit was actually how things have changed since the pandemic. Because we've all seen our practice, you know, massively change as a result of the pandemic. I know we're supposedly coming towards a close in restrictions, and that will be fascinating to see what kind of impact that has on our practice. But in this case, it was really interesting because actually the practice had changed in a way where actually it just meant he was providing the care in a completely different way, in a different setting, still very much, you know, patient contact, face-to-face contact with the patients. In fact, going out to the patients in the cells, which I thought was incredible. Like, I mean, I don't think, because he obviously said it's not the most ideal place to be providing clinical healthcare, and I definitely probably agree with that. But what a fascinating environment to be in, and to practice as a doctor, you know, not the traditional consulting room. And I think that was really, really interesting, and probably one to definitely go and check out if you can.
And I love the way he called those home visits. That was his home visit. He was just really lovely. He really, really saw these people, these prisoners, as people and as patients. And that was really heartwarming. Like, by the end of the podcast, I was just really heartwarmed by the passion and the care that he was delivering for these people.
Something else he mentioned was that the access to patients that they have, it's sort of at the discretion of the prison, and like the GPs and the doctors are guests in the prison service and then within the system. And I thought that was fascinating. So I think we're all acutely aware of perhaps patients' access to us as of GP trainees and GPs through things like e-consult and the phone appointments, and our access to our patients has changed over COVID. So I think that was really interesting to hear that perspective of how the doctor interacts with their patients within the prison service.
Yeah, no, exactly. And going back to that sort of way, I mean, obviously the patient access will be, actually, we didn't really unpick that, but I don't know how the patient accesses the GP, and I wonder, do they tell the prison officers? So that would have been really fascinating to unpick. But you know, we do get taught in our training that you learn a lot from doing home visits and from looking at someone's environment and the environment that they're in. So I wonder how much you can really tell from you and visiting different patients' cells and learn about kind of them and their interactions, because you did mention that a lot of the time actually cells were sort of shared as well. And then some really interesting points around sort of the diversity of the workforce in prisons these days, and the impact that that's had and the change that he's seen over the years. Overall, a really fascinating conversation, Johannes, with a really fascinating individual who loves what he does, and you did an excellent job in just bringing that out of him. So we really enjoyed it, and we really hope that you enjoyed that at home. Thank you for listening to this latest edition of the RCGP Somewhere in Between. Goodbye to my co-hosts, LJ, Kim and Johannes.
Goodbye.
Nicely done. Good hosting.
Thanks. That was good fun. I'm still letting Mira come back to the chair as soon as she's back. We miss you, Mira. We really need you back.